to be a workable battery. There is now a break in the recording because my battery died, but after an interval I got it back, and we will see what happens. All right, so the first project is what are the consequences of laws, second is explaining laws, third is predicting laws, not predicting, designing laws. And for the third one, the simple case is if you think economic efficiency is a good objective, you could then use the same analysis Posner uses, only instead of saying, this is what the efficient rule would be, let's see if it is, you say, this is what the efficient rule would be, let's make it that rule. Notice that you wouldn't have to be, the objective wouldn't have to be economic efficiency. Suppose you had some other objective. Suppose you thought that the law ought to make incomes more equal. Well, a central tool for figuring out whether a particular law does make incomes more equal is economic analysis of law. In particular, Posner would argue, I think correctly, that a lot of legal rules that people would expect to increase income equality, in fact, wouldn't. That if you have, suppose, for example, the implicit or explicit legal rule is that in a dispute between low-income tenants and high-income landlords, you will always, if possible, rule in favor of the tenant. And you might say, well, that's going to tend to help poor people and hurt rich people. And, of course, in the individual case, it will. But if you think through the economics of it, this means that if you are a high-income person who is thinking of becoming a landlord, you will anticipate the fact that you will lose law cases, and you will therefore be willing to become a landlord only if rents are high enough to compensate you for the risks of doing that. So if you work through the logic of this kind of case, it ends up that in the individual case you are benefiting a poor person at the expense of a rich person, but on the net effect you're driving up rents, so that the poor people are in effect getting a tenancy which includes almost a guarantee that in any dispute they win and paying for it. So that would be one example where the rational egalitarian would want to use economics to figure out whether the particular policy he was arguing for did or did not actually help poor people at the expense of rich people, or not at the expense of rich people, for that matter. So although sort of the obvious application of the theory is to figure out how to design efficient legal rules, it really has a more general use. Similarly, I think there's a tendency for people to think of economic analysis of law as sort of a conservative or pro-free market project, and it's probably true on average that people who do it are more likely to be in favor of free markets and small governments than people who do other kinds of law. But in fact, if you wanted to argue for left-wing positions, it would be very useful to have these tools available to argue for them. And to take one example in the book, I have an argument against the death penalty, which as far as I know is not one that's normally made in the literature, and it comes out of the economic approach to these issues. Get back to that later. But anyway, so in general, it's a way of making sense of the law. So of the three projects, I think the least disputable project is figuring out what the effects of legal rules will be. The somewhat more disputable one is explaining laws on this particular conjecture that Posner offers, and then the third is the normative project of change the law in the way you think it ought to be. One feature of economic analysis of law that I think makes it interesting, but perhaps also threatening from the standpoint of the legal academy, is that it tends to unify the law. That, unlike all of you, I've never been to law school. That is, I spent lots of time in law school, but I wasn't taking classes. That, unlike most law professors, I am not, in fact, trained as a lawyer. I'm trained as a physicist, and then switched fields into economics, which I also haven't taken any courses in. But my impression from hanging around law schools for many years is that your first year courses are a bunch of separate courses. That learning civil law doesn't tell you a whole lot about criminal law or about property or things. Now, is that a fair statement or not?
Yep.
Whereas one of the neat things that I hope I'll convince you of by the end of this semester is that the economic analysis unifies it. That once you really understand contract law, you also understand tort law. Because after all, what's a contract doing? It's setting up a two-person tort system. It's setting up the rules that apply to the interaction between two people. And if you figure out what are the rules that rational people would want to set up for their contract, you've figured out what the rules are that rational people would want to have set up for their broader interaction. So if you think, go back again to my general point of getting people to bear the cost of what they do. A sensible contract design will be one in which the party who can control cost A is the one who pays cost A, the party who can control cost B is the one who pays cost B. Right? Otherwise, I'll raise costs that you will pay for and vice versa. That sounds an awful lot like the sensible tort rule, which is that the party whose choices impose a cost is the party who bears those costs. And it turns out, when you think about it, that criminal law and tort law look a lot the same, the main difference being that criminal law is prosecuted by the state and tort law by the victim. And in fact, I have a whole chapter later in the book on what I think of as the crime-tort puzzle, which is why we have two systems of law that do the same thing in different ways. And I think you will see that the same basic ideas turn out to apply right across the spectrum to almost all different areas of legal of law. Now, I say that's both intrigue, both attractive and threatening, because one way of looking at it is that here I am saying to all these people who've spent 20 years studying the law, you realize you can't really understand your subject until you first learn economics. Which is not a good way of making yourself popular. But from the other standpoint, if you've been studying a whole lot of pieces of the law and you'd like to see it unified, the fact that this particular approach has the potential to unify a lot of it is sort of intriguing, at least I think so. Alright, what time is this course supposed to, this class supposed to be over, do you know? 7:15, as I thought, but I wasn't sure. Alright, let me say a little bit about justice, not a subject that will get a lot of attention in this course. A lot of people think that the best way of making sense of the law is in terms of justice. And I think you will find that the approach in this book almost entirely ignores that. And the most striking example is that when we're analyzing criminal law, we give the same weight to the criminal as to the victim. That is, we say that when a criminal steals your car and sells it for $5,000, and it's a $10,000 car, that in terms of properly calculated social costs, that's not a $10,000 loss. That's only a $5,000 loss. Because it's true, you lost $10,000, but you gained $5,000, and it's only the net that's a loss. So that it seems sort of very peculiar, I think, to a lot of people, that we treat criminals that gains and losses to them count exactly as much as gains and losses to everybody else. And yet, it is, I think, a sensible strategy for a couple of different reasons. One of which is that before we've done our theory, we don't know what ought to be a crime. We don't know who's a criminal. Part of what we're trying to figure out is what the law should be. Well, if we say we know that certain activities are bad, therefore people who do them don't count, we're going to get the result that they're bad. We're going to put it in and get it out. That's not very interesting. It's much more interesting if we say criminals count, victims count, everybody counts, and under those rules, we ought to prevent crime. That's a much, prevent robbery, I mean. Crime is already classifying it. But if I say that I can show you why we are all on the whole better off if people can't steal, that's much more interesting than saying if people can't steal, victims are better off. Yeah, sure. But in fact, the more interesting thing is that stealing hurts victims by more than it helps criminals. And that's a reason that doesn't depend on pre-existing moral categories to be against it. So in that sense, we want, I mean, I would have said that part of what's really intriguing about the economic analysis is how much of our moral system you can get out without putting it in. That what you're putting in is this very, very simple objective that I've been describing as maximizing the size of the pie, the degree to which everybody gets what he wants. And from that single objective, it turns out that quite a large part, though not all, of what we think of as moral rules turn out to be rules that make sense in those terms. Now, the second reason, I should say, is that I also don't think we have a very good theory of justice. I don't think I've been arguing lots of these things with different people for, I don't know, 45, 50 years, something like that, I guess starting in high school, and I don't think anybody that I've come up with can really give you a convincing demonstration that theft is wrong from the stand, from a moral standpoint. Well, you'll feel it's wrong, I feel it's wrong, but, you know, you start pushing, and how do we decide what belongs to who, why are you entitled instead of him, and multi-cater, I won't go into it. And I think that's true of everything. I mean, you know, murder really feels wrong, but how would you prove it was wrong? killing people in war, generally most of us think is right. Not everybody, a lot of people do. What's the difference? So it seems to me that the second reason is that, to me, arguments based on moral arguments are on rather uncertain ground. Not that I don't believe in them, and I, like everybody else, I have the view that certain things seem right or wrong, but I'd rather push my arguments on something I understand better, and I understand economics not only better than I understand moral philosophy, but I believe better than anybody understands moral philosophy, because I don't think, though maybe I'm wrong, that moral philosophy really is a science in the same sense. No, maybe I'm wrong. All right. So far, I've been putting everything in terms of what the lawyers can learn from the economists. But it turns out that there's also stuff economists can learn from the lawyers. In particular, the economists tend to deal with things like property and contract in a very abstract form. So we think either you own the land or you don't own the land. If you actually look at property law, you rapidly realize that there is no such thing as owning land or not owning land. What you own are particular rights with regard to the land. And that way of looking at it results in a much more sophisticated economic analysis of the question than the economists would have gotten by themselves. And I suppose the most famous example of this is an article you'll be reading later on by Ronald Coase called The Problem of Social Cost. And there's a story which goes with that article. And the story, in fact, is by George Stigler. It's in his biography. And the story is that all economists knew what the answer was to a certain kind of problem, the problem called externalities. An economist called Pigou had analyzed the problem back in about the 1930s, and basically everybody said, all right, Pigou's got it right. This is how we deal with externalities, with cases where one person's action imposes a cost or benefit on someone else. And Coase comes to Chicago to give a talk, which was basically the material that ends up as this article. And he has dinner at the house of Aaron Director, who was the first editor of the Journal of Law and Economics. And there are about 14 economists at the dinner, of whom I think four or five later get Nobel Prizes, including Coase. And at the beginning of the dinner, there's an argument. And the argument is 13-1. Coase is the one. The other 13 all know that Pigou's view of externalities is correct. By the time they go home, it's 14-0 the other way. And that's, I suppose, a very famous story, at least in Chicago economics. And then Coase publishes the article, which becomes one of the most cited articles of economics, in which he shows, basically, that Pigou has it wrong. That Pigou's approach to the question is indeed the right answer in certain special cases, but Pigou had fundamentally misunderstood both the nature of externalities and, I guess, the nature of legal rules, I guess, that he had assumed that there was a default in the sense in which there wasn't. But we'll get to all of that stuff later. I'm seeing we're running out of time. But that place was the best case I know of where, rather than the economists teaching lessons to the lawyers, Coase, who had studied law, had studied legal cases, and from that studying got ideas that greatly improved economists' understanding of certain issues. If anybody didn't get one of these forms for telling me when you want my office hours, please pick one up now and fill it out. I think everyone got it, but I'm not sure, and please hand in the forms once you've got them. Thank you. You want the URL?
You're what?
International evidence
from Boston. Yes. Yes, I understand. Can you read all right? Because most of what I say is in the book, not the same words, but.
So, I need your
lecture notes. No.
Sometimes I can understand you
here. Yes, if you look here, things on the web page, these are recordings of the classes if you want to listen to them again. And these are PowerPoints from when I did it with PowerPoint. So both of those might be useful for.
Okay. Korea, my main major field is security litigation and anti-litigation.
Yes.
So, I like to
Yes, but it's not mainly about security. If you read the book, you should see that that's not really. It's much wider range of things than that. I'm just trying to figure out how to shut this thing down because I use. Yeah. Just a minute. I use a Mac and this is Windows and I'm just trying to figure out how I get the thing to shut down. Somewhere here there's got to be a shut down thing.
But I promised I will do my best in English.
All right, well, as I say, the fact that it is in writing ought to help at least. Can somebody who knows Windows tell me how to shut this silly machine down? You don't. Can somebody who knows the Windows operating system tell me how to shut this silly machine down? I use a Macintosh, and I would like to shut it down. And I don't know how do I shut it down?
Start.
I got that part.
Hold on. All right. Oh, you can't even shut down.
I can't shut down.
Maybe log out. That'll shut out your session.
All right. And then I can... Then does it let me shut out somewhere?
And then it'll shut out.
Shut itself off. All right. Fine. That's what I wanted to know. Shut down. Thank you. Good luck. I knew a linguist who believed that Korea had the world's best alphabet.
Thank you.
my wife.
These days, we all need to save money where we can. As your car gets older, it will have mechanical problems. Don't get caught with a $2,000 or even $5,000 repair bill if your factory warranty is about to expire or you have no warranty coverage at all.
The second quarter cut will be expected from the first as well, and the talk meeting.
Punishing for cutting down the fairy thorn in the head.
Okay.
16 and at 10:30, it's the San Jose Sharks and Toronto Maple Leafs on Channel 208. You can find details on signing up for the Best of XM at Sirius.com or by calling 1-888-7-BEST-XM. And for more information on these games and other Sirius sports programs, visit us online at Sirius.com/sports.
Sirius.
This is the play-by-play schedule here on SiriusXM Sports for Tuesday, January 11th. All times are Eastern. College Basketball Tuesday night here on SiriusXM. 7, Texas Tech takes on Texas on Sirius 127. Also at 7, it's Clemson and Georgia Tech on Channel 214. Michigan State hosts Wisconsin on Channel 122. And it's Kentucky and Auburn on Sirius 121. 9 Eastern tip-off for Baylor and Oklahoma on Channel 122. Also at 9, Boston College and NC State on Channel 214. Penn State hosts Illinois on Channel 126, and it's Florida against Tennessee on Sirius 121. 5 games on Tuesday's NBA schedule, tip-off at 7 in Philadelphia for the 76ers and Indiana Pacers on Channel 213, and in Atlanta where the Hawks host the Milwaukee Bucks on Channel 212 at 9 Eastern. The Denver Nuggets host the Phoenix Suns on Channel 215. At 10 p.m., the New York Knicks are in Portland against the Trailblazers.
The butter into the flour.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when, after that, I add the whatever the recipe.
Oats or nuts or whatever?
Yes.